Stay tuned for Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah, featuring two film critics with distinctly different tastes in movies, Charlie Jewell of CharlieJewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of ChickFlix.net. He thinks her tastes are shallow. She thinks his are pretentious. Listen in as they discuss and debate new releases and other film-related topics. Let the clash begin.
Hello, this week on Cinema Clash, we are going to talk about several different movies, starting off with The Huntsman: Winter's War, the biggest release of the week.
After Huntsman: The Winter's War, the biggest release, we will talk a much smaller release, Green Room, Punk Rockers Meet White Supremacists.
And it's smaller for a reason, but we'll get to that. And we're also going to talk about an odd anthology movie called Rio City of Love. Is that what it's called? Oh, no, Rio, I love you.
It's so good. Mispronounced the title.
Yeah,
that's how good it is.
It's called Rio, Rio, I Love You, and it's part of some franchise about cities that have a love theme going on.
Finally, we'll end with a think piece called Louder Than Bombs, starring Jesse Eisenberg.
Yeah, and I'm going to mention a couple of the movies that I wish I'd seen this week but didn't have a chance to.
Outstanding. So, Hannah, take us through Huntsman: Winter's War.
Well, I can guarantee you that I liked Huntsman: Winter's War a whole lot more than you did, because of the movies we're going to talk about this week, even though this isn't great, it's my favorite of the bunch. And it is a sort of a precursor story to the Snow White and the Huntsman, which came out a couple of years back. And Chris Hemsworth is back as the hunky huntsman, which makes it a very appealing flick to me. And so I think it's the kind of movie that folks who like a fairy tale story, sort of a twisty fairy tale, will actually enjoy this one on some level. Again, it's not great. It's a forgettable film, but in the moment, I enjoyed it.
You're right about it. It's a classic fairy tale. It is good versus evil. There's no really too much gray area here. There's good guys and there's bad guys. And it's a prequel sequel to 2012's Snow White and the Huntsman that had Kristen Stewart as Snow White. They made so much money, Sony Pictures said, all right, we have to do a sequel. See what happens. And then that whole TMZ bombshell happened. Kristen Stewart got caught having an affair with that director. They didn't want, I don't know, bad vibes or the gossip to carry over to this film. So they made Chris Hemsworth the lead. No more Snow White. No more Kristen Stewart. And they also kept Charlize Theron as Queen Ravenna, the evil witch queen, who died at the end of the last film. That's not a spoiler. You should have seen it already. She died.
Hey, these are fairy tales. Nobody really, it's like a soap opera. Nobody ever really dies. You can't trust any of that.
Well, in the previous movie, Ravenna had a brother. He was her sidekick. He was a bad guy, and you know that was them against the world. Now there is no mention of the brother. Apparently, she grew up with a sister, Queen Freya, played by Emily Blunt. And Emily Blunt she didn't have any designs on power like her sister did. She just wanted a simple life, get married, have a child. But then tragedy strikes, the child dies, and Queen Freya goes full Frozen. Her hair turns white. She starts turning people to icicles. Ice is flowing out of her fingernails. And even the narrator, Liam Neeson, says she takes off for the frozen wasteland to set up a castle, and she turns into the Ice Queen. Those are direct quotes. I mean, Disney should be getting a royalty here, Hannah.
I know. It is very much like a dark, twisty Frozen with dark magic involved. And so it's Frozen for the older set.
This feels like a hasty add-on, attack-on. The characters' stories don't match the first film. In that first film, Chris Hemsworth was grieving. His wife died. Okay, that matches. But Ravenna killed that wife. Here, there's a different story. Chronologies don't match. 7 years later, 7 years before, there's some dwarves here, kind of separate dwarves. There were dwarves in the last one, but they were different dwarves. It feels like a patchwork. It feels like it's held together by scotch tape.
Well, the beauty of it is that I didn't remember the details of the first one. And so the details of the second one not matching up didn't really resonate with me. So it didn't bother me. So I think if you're going into this movie, possibly not having seen the first one, or you're like me and you just enjoyed the escapist feel of the first one is just popcorn entertainment, then I think you'd like this one too. Again, it didn't need to be made. It's not like we were missing this from the theater, But in terms of sitting down for 2 hours and just kind of enjoying the ride, I thought it went by very quickly. Jessica Chastain is in this one. She's excellent. She is really an equal partner to the Chris Hemsworth character. They both were sort of raised together into this army of huntsmen, and they are best in class for sure. They're like Top Gun in their class of warrior. And they fall in love, and it's a forbidden love, and that's what triggers the whole story, is that they're not allowed to be together. And then you've got these two evil queens who are trying to wreak havoc on everyone else's lives. It's escapism, pure and simple, fairy tale, nothing more to read into it.
Did it feel for you kind of like a movie of two halves? There's the two queens, sibling rivalry, jealousies, things that go back a long way, and then the love story between two warriors. And Jessica Chastain, you were right, is a warrior. She holds her own. In fact, she could probably best Chris Hemsworth if she wanted to. I want to mention why it's a forbidden love. Queen Freya, who gets her heart broken and disappears, says, love is bad. In fact, love is a sin, and I'm going to outlaw love. And she said, all kinds of love. So she goes from village to village, slaughtering parents, murdering all the parents to save the innocent kids from parental love. And then she turns those kids into her own army, her huntsmen. What do you think about that one?
It's sort of a little bit like Hunger Games, And so it doesn't make all that much sense. I guess I didn't really make the connection that they would have killed all the parents. I just thought she basically kidnapped all the kids. So I'm not sure that you can make that leap that she
to
killed.
Keep the rating down, but I'm pretty sure we saw people, getting killed.
Well, people are getting killed left and right. It's actually quite violent, and I thought it was pretty violent until I saw the next movie that we'll talk about in a little bit, but then this one paled by comparison in terms of violence. But the love story to me, yeah, certainly is the driving force of this movie, and Chris Hemsworth and Jessica Chastain are your primary leads. When the two queens are together on screen, you've got two really good actresses in Charlize Theron and what's her name?
Emily Blunt.
So they are good. They are compelling to watch when they're doing their scenes, but it does seem all a little bit gratuitous. It really is just to set up this movie in the middle with the Chris Hemsworth character and the Jessica Chastain character. And again, I know you hate when I say it is what it is, but it kind of is what it is. And I think that there is an audience for it. Do you need to run out and see it in the theater full price? No. When it comes across an airplane movie or a rental, is it worth possibly going to see? Sure. If you like the first one, I would go ahead and say you'd probably like this one too.
I did like the first one, and I do not like this one. In fact, the majority of critics are on my side. This has a 17% on the tomato meter. By the way, in the background, I think you can hear our podcat is purring on the couch here. And that's really coming through. So, yeah, absolutely skip it. In fact, find something else to do on the airplane.
I disagree, especially when we hear about this next movie, Charlie.
I can't wait to tell everyone about this awesome Fresh Tomato certified 86% on the tomato meter movie, Hannah.
It's George, called... critics know nothing, but go ahead.
This is a great movie. It's called Green Room. Green Room is by director Jeremy Saulnier. This is his third film, and a couple years ago, he really broke out with his second film in 2013 called Blue Ruin. It was an indie hit, a smash hit, nominated for multiple Indie Spirit Awards. This guy finally made a name for himself, and so now he's decided to do Green Room. Kind of it's an homage to a genre known as the siege thriller. There's people on the inside, they're defending themselves against people on the outside who want to come in and do them harm. In this case, it's a punk band. A punk band is inside their concert venue, they run into a murder scene, and the murderers kidnap them. They won't let them leave. So this is in the tradition of John Carpenter's Assault on Precinct 13, Sam Peckinpah's Straw Dogs, what are we going to do? And it does, it gets very violent. It turns into a slasher film. And I just love the one-liner, punk rockers versus white supremacists. And you're looking at me with this look of horror on your face, Hannah. It's like you didn't enjoy this movie as much as I did.
I hated this movie. I really did. I did not understand why so many people were raving about it. It just is not, first of all, it's not my genre. I do not like horror movies. It's very rare that the only kind of horror type movie that I even like is something like The Conjuring or Poltergeist, that sort of flick. I don't like I Know What You Did Last Summer or Saw movies, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Halloween, any of those kinds of things. And to me, this is just another horror movie, a Blair Witch Project with a bunch of punk rockers in a green room. I did not find anything redeeming in watching it other than waiting for it to end. And the performances are all fine. I thought the actors in it did a fine job. And it's got Patrick Stewart. And that's a weird thing where you've got, as the leader of this white supremacist group, you have, Captain Picard. And it was a very strange role to see him in, a relatively small role. But I just did not like watching it. It wasn't so much about the story or anything. I just was not enjoying myself watching it. The level of violence was just beyond what I prefer to see. And hardcore punk rock music is just not my scene.
The level of violence where, and there's machetes here and shotguns, but it is not to the level of what you would call torture porn.
Yeah.
The Hostel movies, the Saw franchise. This movie is not that bad compared to those. Maybe I'm just desensitized now, but the violence did not really impact me in this at all. I want to tell the story of why Patrick Stewart showed up in this film, and we learned about it because the director was at a Q&A in our screening.
Patrick Stewart, as was his mother, by the way.
Yes, and I'm sure she's very proud. he's in his London mansion reading the script of Green Room, and he said halfway through he got up and locked the door, turned on the security system, and poured himself a scotch before he could read the second half. And he fell in love with the script so much he had to do it. And I think if someone is able to write a script with that much punch, there's something special going on here. A talent has been discovered again. It just played Sundance, so this has a lot of buzz going around. But you're right; it's a small film. the director, so Jeremy Saulnier, he's a local guy. He grew up in the DC suburbs of Alexandria. And back then, DC was a punk scene. It was a city put on the map by Fugazi, Minor Threat, really well-known, internationally famous punk bands. So he grew up in that arena, and he used his experience there and infused it into the film. None of the characters, none of the bandmates are, one-for-one rip-offs of his friends, but they all contain characteristics. And, the main character is, I guess he's the guitarist, Pat. He's played by Anton Yelchin. You know him as the new Chekhov from the Star Wars films, from the Star Wars reboots. And he's funny. He's kind of the unofficial spokesman of the band. He's the one negotiating with Patrick Stewart. They get a hold of a gun, and Patrick Stewart wants them to get rid of that gun. And they're like, all right, we'll trade it for a cell phone. He's like, no, that's out of the question. Well, how about we trade it for a registered firearm? And it's just a hysterical little piece there. And there's an earlier part where they're talking about their desert island bands, and they all, they're posers a little bit. They all name these obscure punk bands. And by the time they're, getting killed off one by one, they come clean. One says, oh, Simon Garfunkel. Another one says Madonna. And you're like, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah. And those kind of moments actually were my saving grace for this movie, because I truly could not wait for it to end. But I don't think anyone who's not into, first of all, if you've ever listened to a punk rock song, if you do not like it, if you don't like that very loud, headbanging kind of vibe, then this movie is certainly not for you. If you are into that scene, if you have ever had any interaction with the punk rocker scene, or other people who do, or you like a sort of quirky horror movie, then you might want to check this out. But for the majority of people, I think this is one that falls into a critic favorite, but I don't think it's going to be a mainstream favorite.
No. This has cult classic written all over it.
It has like, cult classic.
College kids
for a
are going to flock to this
and
thing.
It reminded me of the type. It looked to me like the type of movie that my college friends all made after hours, in film school. That's exactly what it reminded me of.
There's a certain type of energy in a punk song, and I think the director used that energy and put it into the film. It moves. It's never slow. It's very fast. It's very loud.
Very loud.
And did you notice the movie poster? You know, you got, it's Anton Yelchin there with the machete. That's a ripoff of the Clash album London Calling. That's Paul Simon on the bassist is smashing his guitar, and now you have Pat smashing a machete.
Well, see, so if anyone catches that reference, they'll enjoy this movie.
They absolutely will. And I'm not the biggest fan of punk. Like, I'll listen to the Clash, but they are not hardcore.
No.
But I like this movie. It's not as good as Blue Ruin, his previous one. I think he made this movie just because he could, but it's less than Hostel and Saw. I really urge people to go out and check this out.
His mother was in the audience. I really, really, really wanted to find out what she thought about it, and nobody posed that question at the end during the Q&A, but I am indeed curious.
Well, the next film we're going to talk about is also very small, but completely different. What is that, Hannah?
Well, so this is one called Rio, I Love You. And it is an indie movie, and I guess there's a whole franchise that I wasn't even really aware of. But had you seen any of the previous ones, Charlie?
I did. This is the third one. I saw New York, I Love You. I did not see Paris, Je T'aime. But so now I'm 2 for 3.
Yeah, so it's part of this franchise that started with those two movies, and it's an anthology. It's like 10 vignettes all combined into one movie. And unless you sort of go into it really being prepared for that, it's an odd movie to watch, because some of the characters and stuff, they never go back to. And so it is not a movie that wraps up in the end, that ties everything together. The tie is love. Basically, every one of these 10 little vignettes features some sort of interaction about love, either losing love, falling in love, falling out of love, looking for love, and all in different neighborhoods of Rio. The thing that this movie definitely does have going for it is beautiful. It has some gorgeous scenery. If you want like a travelogue movie to see all these different parts of Rio, then this is certainly a movie that might be entertaining in that way, or just worth seeing on a big screen just for the visuals. But I liked probably 4 or 5 of those 10 vignettes. And so that meant I liked about half the movie. And that meant I didn't particularly like the other half. And when you put it all together, I don't know. It's just, it's not a great movie.
I probably liked less of the vignettes than you did. I wasn't a big fan of this. I remember New York, I Love You was much better than this. I had a little fond memory of that one. So since there's 10 vignettes, they're directed by 10 different directors. And some of these directors are very famous. Do you remember the one where the former model is married to the old guy and they go to the beach?
Yeah.
I think it's like the first one.
Yeah, I didn't like that one.
That's directed by Paolo Sorrentino. He won an Oscar for The Great Beauty, and he directed my second favorite film of last year, Youth. And that one stars one of the bigger stars in the film, Emily Mortimer.
That explains it, because I didn't like Youth.
And it's one of the more wry vignettes, one of the more silly ones. It's interesting how that works out. But they never go back to it. Like, I kind of want to see what happened.
Yeah, I mean, there's a homeless woman at the beginning who likes living on the streets, but her grandson is trying to get her to come off the streets, and we never go back to that character. There's a really good one. One that I liked that was most visually interesting was with two dancers who are at a crossroads, and they basically hash out their differences during a shadowed routine that they are performing on stage. And that one I thought was actually very stunning and well directed. And you did feel that that the story tied up, that you got your whole little story in that few minutes.
Well, actually, at the tail end of the film, they give a shot of what happened to those two. And so finally, that one feels good, because they did wrap it up.
Yeah.
There's some other really famous people in here. There's John Turturro. He directed that scene, by the way, of himself. And that's, you've seen those characters before, actually, but different. They were, John Turturro and Vanessa Paradis. They were in Fading Gigolo 2 years ago, which John Turturro also directed, except Vanessa in that one was an Orthodox Jew. That John Turturro was, you know, this Bronx guy was trying, he was a gigolo. So it kind of and Woody Allen was in that one, gives you the genre there. But that one wasn't very good. That's them kind of falling out of love. And it's very hard to understand.
Yeah.
And he's overacting, just something awful, it feels like. Harvey Keitel shows up as an actor. He's playing a priest, and he ends up playing God to this little kid, which is funny.
That
I like how they
one.
Did it.
That I
was
like
okay.
That one.
My favorite one, I think, was the sand sculptor. That's Vincent Cassel. You might remember him from like Four Weddings and a Funeral. This one was directed by Fernando Mireles. He did City of God and The Constant Gardener. So kind of a local boy. He doesn't even talk in that one. He's a sand sculptor and he goes and brings his tools and makes these amazing art sculptures with sand. But the cool part was the square next to it. And so you'd see the joggers and that'd be set to like a marching band music. Or you'd see the businessman, that'd be set to other music. It's really fascinating how that was shot. That's why I think it's my favorite one.
That one kind of just was a fleeting memory to me. It came, it went.
It was fast.
It was fast. It didn't really resonate with me as much of anything. Then there was the vampire one.
The worst one is the vampire.
That was terrible. I'm like, what in the world?
And they break out in song.
Old waiter guy who's like involved with some prostitute, and then his fangs pop out, and he's like, I don't know. The whole thing was just
that
bizarre.
One's about vampire love.
Oh, yeah. So yeah, you needed a little vampire love in there amidst all the other types of love. So that to me was just, it took me out of the movie entirely because I just found that one to be so weird.
Maybe that's why they buried that one in the middle. That's like right at the halfway point.
I guess, but it was just weird. It was just simply weird, and I didn't see the purpose of it. Visually, I think one of the greatest moments is it is a guy who's going hang gliding past the Christ the Redeemer statue.
He's funny. That caused a stir.
I remember hearing about that, and it is very it's just a cute moment, and he's basically this guy who's all pissed off because he's been jilted or something, and he's hang gliding by the Christ statue and basically curses him out for not doing a better job of spreading the love in Rio, and he thinks Rio is a terrible city for love. And so that one was clever and visually very impressive.
Yeah, so there's stronger ones, there's weaker ones, and then there's a lot more weaker ones.
Yeah.
I think this you can call it a franchise, I suppose. They've had 30 directors now and like 30 vignettes. It's losing steam, if it ever had steam. There's rumor. We were talking to a gentleman at another screening who said there was supposed to be two more of these. I really hope there aren't, unless they really up their game.
Yeah, they need to figure out a way to just sort of tighten it up and to give people an ending. You know, I think people want to feel that there's something to tie the whole thing together just a little bit more. And there were too many brunettes in this movie. Honestly, there were so many characters and so many storylines that there were times where I did not know who was who anymore. And I lost track, especially of the women, which character they were.
Man, those women did look alike.
They all looked
they're all
alike.
Gorgeous.
They were all attractive brunettes. And you could have interchanged any one of them within all of these different vignettes. And I just found that just made it more difficult to track this whole movie. And not surprisingly, the end credits, I think, ran for like 10 minutes. I finally had to just turn it off, because the credits just kept going and going and going, because they gave full credits for each of these vignettes. So you had basically 10 sets of end credits.
Well, after our first two movies we talked about and vehemently disagreed on, we're coalescing now in our opinion. This Rio, I Love You is not that good.
We are, however, I would go see Rio, I Love You 100 times more rather than go see The Green Room one more time.
That is such a mistake. That is such a mistake. You can still find a way to hurt me when we're agreeing with the film.
And I got to tell you, the other thing, because when we're talking about some of these other movies, though, that when I went to see The Green Room, I had to skip another movie called Sing Street that is also out this week. And that was by the same guys who did Once and Begin Again. So just to give that movie a plug, because I suspect it's probably better than at least two out of the three movies we just talked about, then I would suggest anybody who really enjoyed Once or Begin Again might want to seek that one out rather than any of these others we've talked about.
I like how you say you were dragged or were forced to go to Green Room. You chose to go to Green Room. You could have gone to Sing Street all you wanted. You just didn't want to go to Georgetown.
I was strongly advised to consider going to Green Room instead. But again, I think this is where your own personal preference in movies really comes into play. And some people who like this genre of the way that Green Room was really did enjoy that movie. But I do think that it is a select audience and most people just should stay away.
No, I think you're onto something. Sing Street does look good. I can't pass my opinion on it. I haven't seen it either, but it was at Sundance by the guy who made Once, and everybody loved Once. I wasn't the biggest fan of Begin Again, but it wasn't the worst movie.
Yeah, and this one's set in, it's set in Dublin. It's 1980, so I have a feeling that anyone who...
Sounds like you too.
It could be. And so it looks sweet. So that's going to be on my list of things to try and catch.
Well, the last film I want to talk about today is one... it's another small film that I got to see. It was at Cannes last year, and it's by a director named Joachim Trier. He's a Dane, but his first two films he directed in Norway, in Norwegian. They were Reprise and one that really broke out in 2011, Oslo, August 31st. That movie takes place in a 24-hour period, and it's a very affecting film. People who saw it still talk about it. Well, this one's called Louder Than Bombs, and now that he made a name for himself, he came to the United States, and he's directed a New York story with English actors, well, mostly English actors. Gabriel Byrne plays the father, he's Irish, and Isabelle Huppert plays the mother. She's a French woman, and she's got a thick French accent, but everyone else is American. And it's about, what do you do, how do you carry on after the sudden death of a family member, a loved one? What's the grieving process like? You know, so in that way, it reminds me of Ordinary People, Best Picture winner. It reminded me of Imaginary Heroes. And it wasn't as good as Ordinary People, but it was better than Imaginary Heroes. And it's quirky. It's not straightforward. It's not linear straight. The dead wife will just walk into the room all of a sudden, and we've like, oh, flashback. And it's 2 years later. She had two boys. Jesse Eisenberg now is out of the house, but his wife just gave birth to an infant daughter, and it looks like he's having problems with that because he has come home now to take care of his mother's affairs, her professional affairs. She was a wartime photographer. They're doing a retrospective on her, and it turns out it's about to hit the news. Her car accident wasn't an accident. She committed suicide. And, oh, thank you, Podcat. You know, he must be sad about that. And, you know, so he's falling apart. There's a younger brother played by a new actor called Devin Druid. He was very good, and he's got some high school problems. And Gabriel Byrne is the father, trying to keep it all together. And it's not the best movie. There's characters that just don't work, like Amy Ryan, great actress. Her character is completely underserved. She's the teenager's teacher, and she's also having an affair with Gabriel Byrne now, and that just doesn't work. But this movie has some weighty issues, some weighty themes, and it gives you stuff to chew on. So if you don't want to see my slasher film, Green Room, this week, and you really don't want to see the fairy tale Huntsman, and you've been scared off of Rio, I Love You, Louder Than Bombs isn't bad. It's a good drama to really to work on and think about.
Yeah, you kind of lost me at the title. I was like, okay, Louder Than Bombs. I still was not quite sure what that one was supposed to be about.
I think it might be emotional.
Doesn't really sound, yeah, do you think? Doesn't really sound like my cup of tea. I mean, do you think I would like it?
No,
really?
No, I'm okay that you didn't watch this. I don't think you didn't miss anything. I watched it because I know the director. I like his previous work very much. And this one, you know, this is an actor's piece. People get to really have some emotional scenes, which is, you know, sometimes you need a good drama, especially to wash out garbage like The Huntsman.
See, and I didn't feel like I needed that cleansing of the palate, except for after The Green Room. However, there are two other movies I just wanted to mention real quick, because they are also out in a lot of places this week. And one, people have asked me about A Hologram for the King, which, as far as I can tell, we did not get an invitation to screen. And that's with Tom Hanks going to the Middle East to pitch a king, and he's a businessman, and it looks, you know, looks cute from the trailers, and it sounds like something that I would have definitely been interested in seeing. But I get a little worried when they put these movies out without giving us any kind of preview screening. What do you think?
A Hologram for the King got buried. I know about it because, you know, I know about movies, but I don't think I ever had the opportunity to see this, ever. Not even like a daytime screening or a tiny little screener link, nothing. This one is, I think it's in one theater in this town. It's probably not in a town near you, wherever you're listening to this. Good luck finding this thing.
But it's Tom Hanks.
Yeah.
It's really kind of surprising. The other one that I do also want to see that I just happen to have missed the screenings and haven't had a chance to catch up on it is Elvis and Nixon. And that one looks like it could be a good little, you know, cross that arty mainstream divide.
That one looks great. I think I was out of town that night that this screened, but it's got a very wide release this weekend. Michael Shannon, Kevin Spacey. I mean, this is, I know the story about in the 70s, Elvis, you know, wanted to be like the counter drug guy.
And irony.
It looks good.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I certainly knew that story. And when I did my, I did one of those, you know, trips to Graceland back in the day. So I remember seeing all the photos of the day that he went to visit Nixon, and he got a little narcotics, a drug enforcement agency badge.
Yeah.
And so as an Elvis fan and as a Kevin Spacey fan, I think I might actually seek this one out at some point.
So best movie of the week, Green Room.
Huntsman.
To wrap it up, we split on Huntsman. Even Hannah's not that excited about it, but she just didn't have a good week of film.
That's right.
I really liked Green Room.
Hannah, I really, really did not.
Yeah, I could see that. We both did not care for Rio, I Love You.
Yeah, it was so-so.
So was Louder Than Bombs. That's so-so. And yeah, keep an eye out for Sing Street, Elvis and Nixon. And if you hear anything about A Hologram for the King, let us know.
Yeah, absolutely.
Next week, we're going to talk about the newest animated movie, Ratchet and Clank. Keanu, starring Key and Peele, and a cat, I believe. And a movie called Doe. I think you know more about that than I do right now.
Yeah, it was something. It's a indie about a baker. It's got some sort of Palestinian, Israeli, London mix of people.
In time for Passover.
Yeah, just in time for Passover. So it's I've heard good things about it, so I'm looking forward to seeing it. It looks like it could just be one of those sort of hidden gem indies.
All right. As always, I am Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com. And with me is my fabulous co-host, Hannah Buchdahl.
Thank you, Charlie. And to all who celebrate, have a happy Passover.
Cinema Clash with Charlie and Hannah is presented twice each weekend on RadioSt.Pete.com at 5:15 Eastern on Saturday and 9:15 on Sunday mornings. Cinema Clash with Charlie Jewell of charliejewell.com and Hannah Buchdahl of chickflix.net. Listen again for Cinema Clash on RadioSt.Pete.com.